Hello and welcome to Beth Tikkun and this series called Spiritual Seasons. In this series, we are exploring the Torah portions in the light of the spiritual calendar, drawing out connections between each portion and the spiritual season of the year in which we read it. Today, we are in the double portion of Vayechel and Pekudei, the final six chapters of Exodus, starting in chapter 35. So in recent teachings, we have been focusing on how the portions we are reading now in the month of Adar connect with and help to support our highest point of development in the whole year. The calendar will soon start over with Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the first month. Nisan begins next week on Wednesday night. So this final portion in Exodus is actually the last portion that is fully within this spiritual year. We've come to the end. And what a glorious double portion this is. In some years, it's read separately when it's a leap year. But when it's not a leap year, they're read together. So let's summarize the portion or the portions now. Vayechel follows the interruption of the golden calf, right? All this is, God is giving this these instructions to Moses, and it's interrupted by the golden calf and the aftermath and Moses interceding for Israel. And so the portion begins with Moses gathering the people together into a kahal, an assembly. He first reiterates to them the commandment to rest on the Sabbath. He then tells them what is needed for the construction of the tabernacle, what things they need to donate. 35:20 says, "Then all the congregation of the people of Israel departed from the presence of Moses, and they came, everyone whose heart stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him, and brought the Lord's contribution to be used for the tent of meeting, and for all its service, and for the holy garments." As they begin working, the people keep bringing more every morning until they have to be told to stop because they have more than enough. The work progresses under the leadership of Bezalel and Oholiab. Interestingly, the order of how the tabernacle is created is something like the reverse of the vision God gave Moses on the mountain. God begins with the furniture. It starts with the ark there on top of the mountain. And he goes on to the tent itself with all the curtains and such and finishes with the repetition of the Sabbath. So in this portion, when the thing is actually being made, Moses begins with the commandment for the Sabbath. Then the people create the tent itself, including the curtains and the coverings and the clasps and the frames. And then lastly is the furniture, which again starts with the ark. So it's the reverse order. And so we'll talk about this idea again a bit later. Portion Pekudei begins with an accounting of all the weights of gold, silver, and bronze used in the construction of the tabernacle. Pekudei then goes on to describe the making of the clothing for the priesthood. So it's kind of interesting that at the end comes new clothing, holy clothing, which is something we also see in the book of Revelation, new clothing at the end. When all is finished, the people bring everything to Moses, and Moses sees what they have done. And this is the very special verse that describes that moment. "And Moses saw all the work, and behold, they had done it. As the Lord had commanded, so had they done it. Then Moses blessed them." God then speaks to Moses, telling him to set up the tabernacle and inaugurate Aaron and his sons on the first of Nisan. So God is being very specific with the dates here in the calendar. The first day of this first month is when they are to set it up. And so Moses does so on the first day of the second year of the wilderness journey. And the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle with his presence in a mighty way. And Moses isn't even able to go in because of the cloud. And so the people of Israel put behind them one of the most momentous years any people have ever had in the history of the planet. It started in Egypt with the finishing of the plagues and proceeded to the foot of Mount Sinai, where they saw the God of the universe come down on a mountain like fire, and finished with God drawing yet nearer to them, dwelling in the midst, in their midst, in a home that they constructed with their own hands. It was a year for the ages. And yet, every bit of it is showing us what we walk through every year too, because we walk in the footsteps of Israel, because we too are Israel. So one reason I really like this portion is that you can see the people are so eager to worship God here. They have this great need within them to worship. And so this was at the root of the golden calf incident. They wanted to worship God. But I think their desire has even increased here. And Moses, in giving the instructions for the tabernacle, is giving them the pathway for doing that, doing the worship that they want to do. He's giving them the kosher path, right? Not the golden calf. So there's a special kind of passion here that we can see in their contributions and in their taking upon themselves of this work wholeheartedly. It's a passion that comes from a brush with death. It's a passion that comes from not knowing if they would live or die, only to have God extend the hand of forgiveness to them in the end. It's the passion of the Baal Teshuvah, right? The one who has wandered away and has ended up in the pit and has returned and has been embraced with a welcome back that he didn't deserve. There is a deep thread in Jewish teaching about the lost one who returns, the Baal Teshuvah, who is like the prodigal son in Yeshua's parable. Over time, many Jewish teachers have recognized that in many ways, the one who goes astray and returns can go even higher with the Lord than the one who never strayed to begin with. And we see references to this idea in the apostolic scriptures, even directly in Yeshua's words about the ones who love much. The Jewish sages also say that receiving that grace fills us with a love for God that touches us so deeply that this love goes beyond even the love a tzaddik, you know, a righteous one, is capable of. The people who a short time ago had fashioned an idol and who were disciplined harshly, you know, there was a plague and several thousand were killed by the Levites, they're now being given the opportunity to use their own hands to express their regret and their thankfulness for God's forgiveness and their desire to know him better and have him live among them in a special way. They could be dead. But instead, they get to use their living hands to bring their Creator to earth. And this fills them with a passion. It's a huge reversal that has happened. And you can see why they are so eager to contribute their precious things to the work. So what good would any of that stuff have been to them if they were all lying there cold and lifeless, just becoming food for the desert animals there? You know, what use is it? Give it to the Lord for his house. He's kept us alive, right? It's a beautiful portion that just sings of giving and unity and the sweetness of having arrived at a place of healing together. And, you know, it's a great light that shines out of the darkness of Egypt. These chapters in Exodus have always been some of my favorites in the Bible, and I'm not sure that I could always put my finger on why that is, and maybe I still can't quite. I just really like these chapters in Exodus. So this is a different people who are filled with the passion of being given back their life, of being returned to life. I want to make a quick second point here before turning to connecting this portion to the calendar. There is a finite amount of time open for the people to contribute here. They needed to be quick if their contribution was to be accepted and, in the end, counted among the offerings used in the tabernacle. The sages say that when a person intends to do a good deed, he or she shouldn't delay. Be quick about it. And we see a verse like that in Romans 12:11, and you can check that out. Let this week's portion be a reminder to us that we are only given a certain amount of time to be the Lord's hands and feet in this place. And not only that, but the more we give our life away here, the more of an adventure we're going to have, right? So take advantage of that time, give your life away. The adventure only increases. As we turn now to doing a little work to place this portion in the calendar more directly, I'd like to take a look at the two names, Vayechel and Pekudei. Vayechel means, and he assembled. And you can hear the word kahal in Vayechel. And Grant often used the word kahal in place of the word church. A church is an assembly, a gathered group. So again, the title of the portion is pointing us toward the unification that is such a strong characteristic of the end of the cycle, the salvation pattern. We see here an echo of the last portion, Kitisa, which means when you lift, you know, talking about the census, when you lift the head to be counted as part of the body of Israel. We're seeing this unification, this coming together as a body that's happening at the end. So we spoke last week about how we underestimate the power of the Moedim, right, the appointed times, the holidays, to set a rhythm and unite people together. Eventually the whole world will pulse with the heartbeat of the Moedim. But in the same way that especially Gentile believers tend to underestimate the power of the Moedim, we also tend to underestimate the power of the temple to unite people, to unite the world. What a powerful thing it is to have a physical place like Israel that all people will recognize as holy. In the future, people from around the world will get off a plane at Ben-Gurion Airport and be especially conscious that they are in a land that is set aside as none other is set aside. It's a holy land set aside. And even more, with their gifts in hand, these pilgrims will travel by train and by bus and by car, if we still have those at that time, to one place, Jerusalem. And as they crest some hill or other, they will catch their first glimpse of a fully restored temple gleaming on the Temple Mount with smoke rising from the courtyard. And as they approach, they will be drawn together in that moment, drawn to the others who are sharing the moment with them, right? The other people around them, people from other cultures and languages as they ascend the steps. And they will feel in the depths of their soul that they are in the Holy Land among the holy people who speak the holy tongue. And now they are at the holiest place of all where God has chosen to put his name. I mean, it's a beautiful image. It does the heart good to think about these future, what the future will look like. So let me just pause here to ask a seemingly unrelated question. What ended the Babylonian and Persian exile? Well, the land was given its rest, right? So it needed 70 years of rest to make up for the Sabbaths of the land that it wasn't given. But there's a central point around which the nation is gathered together, and what they are coalescing around is clear from the very beginning before a single Jew sets foot on the way back to Jerusalem. Here's what it says at the beginning of Ezra. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let each survivor, in whatever place he sojourns, be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods and with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. So do you see how God is reuniting his dispersed people? It is through the rebuilding of the temple. And so it is that the Jewish people consider themselves to still be in exile, even to this day, even though the nation of Israel has been reconstituted in the land. Praise the Lord for that. They will not consider this millennia-long Roman exile to be over until they have rebuilt the temple. It has a critical role in uniting them. And so they think of themselves as still dispersed in a diaspora until the temple is rebuilt. So let me slip in a quick point here about including people who are a bit different among us. We're seeing a backlash now against the woke call to inclusion that is demanding everyone accept and approve of every kind of moral degeneracy. And so they use this word inclusion. Everybody has to be included. They use that word a lot. And as we push back against this madness, we need to be careful that we still make it a priority to welcome into our communities those dealing with mental and physical handicaps, right? We must not overreact against the word inclusion. Believers in particular should be marked by the compassion we show to the most vulnerable. So let's redouble our efforts to invite and welcome in these lovely souls, even as we fight against that word inclusion, right? Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. So let's continue moving forward now. As we continue making connections here to the calendar, there's a little something hidden in the very first sentence of the portion that I find to be beautiful and which teaches us about an aspect of maturity. We're talking about the end of the cycle and maturity. What is Moses gathering the people for in this portion? We know it's to build the tabernacle. But listen to the exact wording of the sentence. It says, Moses assembled all the congregation of the people of Israel and said to them, these are the words that the Lord has commanded you to do. These are the words, the Devarim, that God has commanded you to do. So this phrasing takes us all the way back to the beginning, to Genesis 1, where God creates by his words, right? By his Devarim. But it's different here because this moment is a higher state of development for the creation. God's overall goal is not to speak and create as at the beginning, but to speak to mankind and let mankind work together with him to bring forth creation. So this is maturity. With immaturity, God speaks and it happens. With maturity, God speaks to his bride and the bride gives of herself to bring forth that creation, that fruit. His words are the seeds that she gives a body to. And this physical fruit that reflects spiritual growth is something we should see at the end of the cycle. We should see fruit. And so we are to see this tabernacle not just as God's home and a place to draw near to him and worship him. It's also the physical fruit of a year of walking with him. So the tabernacle is the archetype of the fruit of redemption in our lives, right? We're seeing, in a way, the first picture of redemption here as God redeems a people out of Egypt. We're really seeing what this redemption looks like here. And what do they do at the end of the first year of redemption? Right? So let me repeat that again. The tabernacle is the archetype of the fruit of redemption in our lives. So if you want to know what it looks like to produce good fruit, one important place to look is the tabernacle, and especially these portions here that end the book of Exodus and that end the cycle of months, at least this year. The two are ending very close together, Exodus and the spiritual year. And we need to be looking for tangible fruit in our lives as evidence that we are growing. So we need to be seeing physical fruit in our lives. Receiving the vision is one thing, but wholeness is found in the doing of the vision, exactly according to the vision. Insight, understanding, knowledge, these are good, and they are necessary beginning points for godly action. But insight is useless without the doing. And I think this is why we're seeing all this description of the tabernacle repeated. God is giving over a lot of precious space in his Torah to this repetition. First, God gives the vision to Moses on the mountain. But the real goal is the reflection down below in the physical world of action. So we see a kind of mirror image happening here with the order, a reflected image. The vision on the mountain is furniture, tent, Shabbat commandment, and the mirror image below is Shabbat commandment, tent, furniture. It's the same, just reversed, and that's what happens with a mirror reflection. It's the same, just reversed. So let's skip forward now to Pekudei. Pekudei means accountings or records. It's the idea of here's what ended up happening in the end. It comes from the verse that begins the summary of the amount of gold, silver, and bronze they end up using. And so the verse begins, these are the records of the tabernacle of the testimony. So on the one hand, there is a sense that this summary of metals that got used in the building, is exactly what we should expect at this point according to the salvation pattern. But on the other hand, we need to be quite careful when counting anything, particularly people. Now, we're not counting people here. We're counting gold and silver and bronze. But there's something about counting that we just need to be careful with in general. So as Grant has taught us, counting people is best left to God. And so why is that? Counting is a little bit like hemming something in with a fixed quantity, reducing something to a number. And that's quite tricky. It requires a very deep knowledge of what you're counting to be able to do that. And our vision is a little bit limited. God's vision is unlimited, right? He can do the counting. So this is a kind of reduction when we put these numbers on the thing. It's a kind of reduction to a fixed form. And actually, that's the gift of the bride. That's the gift of the bride. The woman who crafts within herself the physical body to be the home for the spirit of a child, right? There's a spirit. It needs a body. The woman has the ability to make the body, the fixed form for the child. So the bride's job is to take the spiritual and bring it into the physical realm by giving it that fixed form. So this requires paring down the millions of possible physical forms to just the right one for that spirit. So the idea of fixing something in the physical is, in a way, the goal of the whole pattern. It's the end point, what the bride is made to do. All right, so it's not a coincidence that in this final portion, we're seeing this real fixed hemming in, these numbers, this physical shell. On the other hand, we must be extremely careful with the numbering of things and the labeling of things. We can never forget that the physical form is just the tip of the iceberg, the part we can see. The spirit of a person is vast and multifaceted. So we have to be in the business of seeing the outside, but also looking deeper into the spirit of a person. So let me illustrate this idea by speaking to what's happening here in this Torah portion. What the people of Israel did when Moses asked for contributions was to give from their hearts. They just poured out. It was a spiritual act as their hearts overflowed with gratitude and love for God. They sensed that they almost perished because God was angry with them, but God decided to spare them. And now Moses comes with this wonderful news that God wants them to build a home so he can live among them and travel with them, a place for them to worship him. So they pour out their hearts of gratitude with contributions. And here in Pekudei, this complex spiritual act gets translated into 29 talents and 730 shekels of gold, 100 talents and 1,775 shekels of silver, and 70 talents and 2,400 shekels of bronze. So do you feel what happened there? This soaring act connected to God's grace and the people's sorrow and joy and repentance and hope for the future is reduced to so many talents and shekels of these three metals. Okay, so there's a great depth of meaning, actually, in these numbers. And I've heard a rabbi talk about that before. But on the surface, it just looks like numbers. So clearly, since this is the Torah, this is what is good and right to do in this moment, this summary, this accounting. But there's some kind of close connection here to death as well, which is also to be expected at the end of the cycle, right? At the end, you die. That's just the reality. The idea of hemming something in, putting it into a box, is related to the idea of curse in the Bible. So the opposite of curse is blessing. When we are blessed, we have to widen our tents. We expand. We are not confined. When we are cursed, we are trapped in fixed walls that can't move, like these numbers sort of are. And so we see in Hebrew that one word for curse and the word for female are the same root, nakav. Female is nekeva. The idea of curse and female are connected. So does this mean that the bride is cursed or that women are the source of curse because they're in the business of providing a fixed physical form? Well, God forbid. I think what's going on here is that in the end, we human beings reach a final tangible form, and that's good, and that's a feminine process. That's what God wants. But on the other hand, we can never treat that final form as if it is all there is. When we do that, we are reducing the spiritual to the merely physical, and that's deadly. We humans are given the challenge of constantly seeing only the physical, right? That's all we see is the physical. It's always around us. It's always filling our vision. But the challenge is that we always need to be seeing beyond to the spiritual source. We are to use the physical only as a beginning point for understanding. And so we're reaching that greatest point of physical expression right now in the year. But what we see is not what, there's a giant spiritual progression and growth that has happened that's beyond what we're seeing. So here's one of the points I'm driving at in this discussion. So if all of the previous discussion was a bit much, just listen now to this point. We need to be very careful with reducing people down to an adjective or a political party or a gender choice. As weighty for a person's life and our whole society as such a choice is. Yes, we can make a note of someone's worldview and whatever characteristics we see and whatever choices they are making that we can see. We need to take note of these things, of what we can see, right? And we also need to acknowledge that their choices, the ones that don't agree with the Torah especially, you know, they have a big effect on our society when they don't agree with the Torah. And we need to stand firm in the judgment that we're making, right? We see this, this is okay, this is not okay. I mean, we don't necessarily have to speak that out all the time, but we stand firm in what we see that's right and wrong. At the same time, we always acknowledge that a person is much more than any given characteristic or choice. We lose the ability to communicate with someone when we reduce a human made in God's image to a stub, a few words, or a label in our minds. This reductionism is not God's way. In Yeshua's time, when someone was crucified, they reduced the convicted person to the title of the crime. They wrote this crime on a sign. So maybe the sign said rebellion or thievery. Their life was summed up by that fatal mistake. The whole complexity of their life, both the good and the bad they did in their life, were reduced to their crime. For Yeshua, this crime was described as King of the Jews. So this was accurate, but even this was an aspect of the curse he bore on that day. He's more than that, and it's an insult to put a label on the Messiah that's meant to be the summation of his life, to put him in the box of those few words composed of a few letters. So why does the Torah do this here in this portion? Why is the last portion of Exodus named Pekudei, an accounting? Well, as we said before, what comes at the end is the final physical form, and this is as it is supposed to be. It is the goal. And when the final form is revealed, we are removed from this life, and we have to give an accounting. We are judged. We can replace the translation accounting here for Pekudei with the word judgment. And the good news here is that the judge is not a human being. As we've been saying, human beings have to tread very lightly in this area because our vision is so limited. But the one who judges at the end is beyond humanity. And praise the Lord for that. Ultimately, we will all have to stand before the King and give an accounting for what actually ended up happening in this life. And as Grant would often say, that's not just a bad thing. The word judgment is neutral. On the one hand, our judgment will be the basis for regret when we see how much more we could have done had we only had the faith for it. But on the other hand, the judgment is also the basis for our reward. We can be encouraged that though humanity struggles with judgment, God judges perfectly. So let's let Pekudei be a reminder to us today that very near the end comes a judgment, an accounting of what happened in this life. Well, I'd like to move on and make one more point connected to the calendar here. One of the paradoxes of Adar is that scientists say we are very prone to depression at this time of year. Yet Purim and Adar are in general meant to be the season of greatest joy in the whole year. In some places, the winter is just dragging on, right? We woke up just a couple days ago here in Ohio to snow on the ground, right? And in some places, you know, it's even worse than here. Just imagine up in Minnesota and Canada there. And we can just be exhausted. Spiritual coldness is a danger here, and that's related to depression. So Israel, too, could have fallen into a kind of depression at this point in the story. After the incident of the golden calf, the people hear through Moses that God called them a stiff-necked people, and they mourn over that. They're sad. In chapter 33, it says, when the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do with you. Therefore the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. So there's a heaviness that comes upon the people here that I don't think they completely shake off. It's something You know, it almost sounds like they don't put their jewelry back on for 40 years. But it's one thing to take a lesson as they do here. I mean, they take a lesson from this. I think their taking off of the jewelry is their demonstration that they're taking a lesson here. But it's another thing to sink into depression. So Rabbi Akiva Tatz teaches that depression results when all the pathways before us seem to have closed down. All the time and energy and hope we had invested in a certain pathway, right? A marriage, a business, it suddenly came to nothing. And the path forward is obscure. And why should we even try again if the path can end so suddenly like that? And he makes the beautiful point that our bodily reaction to this lack of inner vision is to flood our eyes with water, right? Our body is meant to reflect what's going on in our spirit. There's a reflection going on. What happens inside is reflected outside. That's an important thing to remember in Joshua, and Joshua chapters 13 and 14. There's a reflection going on between the tribes and the land that they inherit. But anyway, Rabbi Tatz says that the way our body reflects depression is that we cry, that our organ of vision, which is our eyes, are flooded with water, which is the element of chaos and dissolution. So our inner vision is obscured, and so our outer vision is also obscured. And he says that what we must do eventually is get moving. And that is what Israel is doing here as they build the tabernacle. Even if we don't know where we are going, we start going anyway. Move anywhere, right? So where will they end up in this journey with God, in this journey in the wilderness? They can't see at this point, but they start doing anyway. He gives them the task of making a home for him, and this is a gift. He gives them a short-term goal. Create something intricate and beautiful with your hands. Work together to do it. In faith that you will live and not die, in faith that there are great blessings in store, in faith that healing will come, start doing. Don't sit just because you don't know where to go or you're too afraid to choose another path. Go anyway. Start moving and ask where you're going later. And you just might find that God will step near to you as you start to move. So Rabbi Aaron Raskin tells the story of Rav Hanina Mendoza. This is a real person, apparently. He was once on the way to the Holy Temple, but he was a very poor man. And he sees how the Jews around him are bringing these beautiful fat cows and sheep for sacrifices. And he knows he can't do that. But he didn't just leave dejected. He went to the outskirts of town, Jerusalem, and found there a huge, beautiful white stone. And he thinks, this would be wonderful on the temple grounds. He doesn't think about how he'll get it there. He just starts carving it with decorations. And when he thinks it is complete and befitting for the Holy Temple, he looks around him for some porters to help transport the stone. He sees that a group of five porters, and he says, you know, fellas, I need your help. What do you want? He says, I need your help to move this to the temple. And they say, sure, for 50 shekels, we'll do that. 50 shekels? You got to be out of your mind. What about 5 shekels? 5 shekels? No way. And they leave him standing next to the stone that he has put so much work into. A moment later, he turns around and he sees 5 men standing there. These are 5 different men. And he calls them over and explains the situation. Can I offer you 5 shekels for this? Oh, yeah, we'll take 5 shekels. We'll schlep it over there for you to the temple, but you have to put at least 1 finger on the stone. So this is the story that Rav Hanina told. And so he says, sure. He puts his finger on the stone, and the next thing he knows, in the blink of an eye, he's standing in the middle of the Holy Temple. He turns around, you know, to pay the men, and they had vanished. So he's standing there in the temple. He's standing where the Sanhedrin meets, And he goes to the Sanhedrin and he tells them this story, and they decide that he was helped by angels. And this was recorded. So I'm not sure why I like that story so much, but one thing we can take from it today is that sitting down and doing nothing isn't an option. You know, the poor guy has no money. He can't buy a cow and he can't buy a sheep, but he doesn't let that depress him. Do something, even if you're not quite sure what that road is taking you, you know, to, where it's taking you. And your spirits will be lifted. And you just might be surprised how God will come along and carry you when you need it, because you stepped out in faith to honor him just by getting moving again. I'm not going to accept this depression. I'm going to move. So I want to zoom in now on one particular item, the laver or kior. It's made from the mirrors of the women who served at the entrance of the tent. And so there are some who make the lovely point that the surrender of these mirrors is like a releasing of ego and self-focus. Obviously, a mirror is used to see yourself, right? The fact that these have been melted down and now hold the water for cleansing the priests is a kind of poetry connecting surrender of self to the cleansing of others, which sounds a lot like Yeshua. So let me say it again. In the laver made of donated mirrors, we see the surrender of self or self-focus that leads to the cleansing of others. And what did Yeshua do on the cross? He surrendered himself, and that led to the cleansing of the world. So let me add one more point about this laver. There's something special about this vessel because the service of the priesthood begins here. It's the first stop. They must wash their hands and feet here before they go about doing other business in the Mishkan. So the laver has a special first quality to it, and firstness is like the seed that contains the rest. So the laver has something to teach us about the whole tabernacle, and it's made of mirrors. So the tabernacle is, as a whole, is especially reflective, right? The writer of Hebrews tells us that the reason God impresses upon Moses so strongly that it must be made exactly according to the pattern shown him on the mountain is that it is a reflection of the heavenly tabernacle. And the high priest who ministers at the heavenly tabernacle is Yeshua. So the water in the laver is literally reflective, right? If you look into the water, you'd probably see the sky. And the base is made from mirrors. The whole of the tabernacle, right, which we can say that the laver represents in a way, the whole of the tabernacle is especially clearly reflecting the upper realm, the heavenly tabernacle. And of course, we know that we too are temples of God's Spirit. So the application here is that we too are to be reflecting the upper realm. We also must follow God's description of the true reality to the T. If God shows us that the true reality above is unity within a body, then what are we doing down here to accurately reflect that unity within a body? What are we doing? What are we doing about that? Let's be about the business of community and connection and self-sacrifice. That's how we become accurate mirrors. So the last point I want to make for these portions today comes from Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, again through Rabbi Raskin. So he brings down this bit of advice from Rabbi Schneerson. He gives the some practical decorating advice, okay? So he requested that in order to bring the aura of the temple, right, the feeling of the temple into each home, in order to make each home into a miniature sanctuary, each home should have a prayer book, a book of the Torah, and a charity box. So these three are connected to prayer, Torah, and the fulfillment of the commandments, good deeds. And he said this is especially, should be the case in children's rooms. From the moment that they are born, these three should decorate the room to bring in as early as possible the ethos of the temple, that they be surrounded with the scent of the temple. And more than decorations in the home, these should be used for prayer and for Torah study and for good deeds. I mean, they can be a children's siddur and a children's tzedakah box, you know, and a children's, you know, komish, or whatever they can first get into reading. But they can do the charity box right away, take their hand and put the coin in the charity box. So I thought that was an interesting, like a little practical application to how we make our homes in our rooms into little versions of the temple. Well, let's turn now to a view of Yeshua in the light of this conversation today and bring out another idea connected to the calendar in the end of the cycle. So we've been making some connections to Yeshua along the way, but I want to return to the names of this double portion, Vayakel and Pekudei, meaning and he assembled and accountings. In Yeshua, we are first gathered together into a people like Vayakel, a kahal, a church, an unlikely gathering from around the world. And we are given a period of time to contribute, to do our part in building his kahal. And then he returns, and there is an accounting, Pekudei. There is an accounting for what we did in this life. And who is the judge? Yeshua is the judge. Yeshua, having lived a human life, knows what it is like to be a human being. We don't always think of Yeshua as the judge, the one who oversees the accounting that comes at the end. But Yeshua is very clearly connected to this moment in Scripture. So let me just take a moment to read some of these verses that describe Yeshua as the judge who oversees the accounting of what we did with the precious time we were given here. So from Acts 10, it says, they put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him on the third day, and he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. From Matthew 25, it says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. And from John 5, it says, for as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will. For the Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son, just as they honor the Father. So lastly here today, let's turn to Joshua chapters 13 and 14. We read in these chapters the first description of the territories east of the Jordan given to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. In chapter 14, we also read the story of how faithful and wholehearted Caleb gets Joshua's blessing to go and take a special inheritance, the city of Hebron, or Hebron, and the land around the city. As we begin to see the territories being portioned out to the tribes, we should keep in mind that this whole process of dividing up the land is being divinely influenced. Though I wouldn't be able to explain how this works for each tribe, every tribe, what we know must be the case is that every tribe's allotted territory somehow reflects the inner character of that tribe. And so this is appropriate for our discussion here because in the end, you inhabit the body, the physical form, and that physical form is a reflection of what has happened in you. And so that is what we're ultimately seeing here happening in these chapters of Joshua where they're getting their individual territories. Well, if that's the case, the big question here is what does it mean that several tribes settled east of the Jordan? And from their original proposition to Moses, we know that they recognized that the land suited them, right? The very first time they proposed to Moses, let us settle here. They say, we have a lot of flocks. This is a land for flocks. They realize that that land suits them, and so especially their livestock. I think there's probably room to criticize these tribes, at least Reuben and Gad. We don't really have a record of Manasseh requesting to settle on the east side. So splitting Manasseh may have been done partly as a way to keep the two sides, east and west of the Jordan, connected. Split one tribe, but they will stay connected. So I'm not going to criticize them today. I'm going to note that Moses doesn't disapprove, at least not after they say they're willing to cross over and help to fight for the land. I'm going to say today that the eastern tribes actually did something brave because they put themselves out there on the flank, right? A tribe would feel safer if its territory was mostly surrounded by other Jewish tribes, but these tribes bravely decided that they could act as the buffer. And there's something that these tribes on the east all have in common that speaks, I think, to that braveness and the role of protector. So what do they have in common? They're all first sons of their mother. So Reuben is the first son of Leah, Gad from Zilpah, Manasseh from Joseph's wife. And so Manasseh is a descendant of Rachel. So we have Leah, Zilpah, and Rachel represented. And there's just one of Jacob's wives missing from the east side of the Jordan. So who was the first son of Bilhah? It was Dan. And where does Dan end up migrating to? At least some of them end up in the far northeast near Mount Hermon, again east of the Jordan. So all four of them are first sons of their mothers, and each of the four is from one of Jacob's wives. It seems like a little too much to be coincidence. So what does it mean? I think it means that God puts a little something extra in the soul of firstborns to protect the family, even if that means they endanger themselves, right? One of the roles of the firstborn is protect the family. And somehow those eastern lands were calling to these four because they were suited to them. And I'm sure there's much more going on there that I can't quite see right now. We can rest assured that no detail of Israel's history happens by accident or coincidence, you know, but we can just build on these things that we notice. Somehow those tribes were drawn to that land, and that land is the appropriate reflection of them. Well, we'll leave it there for today. May God forge us into a deeply united people, a people that is quick to do good while we have the opportunity, a people that has one eye always looking to that time when we will give an accounting before the judge. And may he make us into the people that he wants us to be. And we say together at the end of a book of Torah, Chazak, Chazak, Venit, Chazek, be strong, and let us be strengthened. Shalom.